And when you put that into context of 5% of global maritime trade goes through the Panama Canal and 40% of US container traffic, big numbers out there. But we've also come to rely on those timescales, on the short timescales that we currently have. I expect next day delivery or delivery within a couple of days. Hello and welcome to Being Crisis Prepared, the business continuity podcast from Envroy Crisis Management. I'm Matthew Wardner, Envroy's Managing Director, and today I'm delighted to be joined by David Payne, one of our senior consultants. Good evening, Matthew. I just wanted to start today by drawing from the news, really, and I think that's going to be the podcast all the way through today. But on today's news, I pick up that you see Southampton Football Club, their stadium at St. Mary's is closed, or they've called off one of their championship matches this evening because of a fire, not in the stadium, but next door to the stadium in the industrial state. And it just struck me that it's another one of those examples of our resilience being challenged by things that are outside our control. I think that could be the theme for today's podcast, is things that are outside our control but are just around us that we are then the victim of, if you like,
that we still have to respond to.
We have to respond to, despite the fact it's not our fault, if you like. And another one of these that is in the news at the moment is a resilience topic is reputational damage and that idea of your brand being damaged and therefore your attractiveness to your client customer base is damaged. And in the UK, there's been each of the political parties has had a little bit of that in the last period, whether it be the Labour Party with the Rochdale debacle of their not being able to have one of their politicians stand because of something the previous candidate said. Conservative parties just had a cabinet minister had to pay damages to an academic for an accusation that was found then to be untrue. SNP up in Scotland, the financial challenges to their party that is now a year since the police raided Nicola Sturgeon's house and all the accusations of wrongdoing there. And then just today, Chelsea striker Sam Kerr and court case that's been adjourned involving her. And obviously, it's not for us to say, certainly not for me to say, you're guilt or not guilt. And it's not for the club to say, but the club is impacted by just the accusation of wrongdoing of one of the world's global sort of superstars. It's that sort of, okay.
Yeah, it's that crisis comms moment, isn't it, of do we fight this? Do we need to fight this? How do we fight this? Is it going to grow arms and legs if we don't say anything? And what do we say?
Outside
our control, but we've still got to consider it and potentially form our teams and certainly have those discussions.
Yeah, and if being crisis prepared is all about how do you maintain your outputs and delight your customers so that they're still willing to give you money for what you do or support you for what you do so that you can continue. Well, if your reputation and brand is damaged, that's a resilience issue. So
potentially through no fault of your own.
Yeah, through no fault of your own. So I just thought there's a couple of quick ones there that we could start off with. That there are two issues today that David and I would like to focus on. One is all about supply chain and supply chain management, and one is a people issue. David, which one would you like to start with?
I think we should start with the supply chain one because think this was really interesting. I read this one this morning, and I'm sure other people have read this as well. But it wasn't something that I was particularly aware of. We're aware of the Houthi rebels and the impact that people are having, or the impact that is having on the Suez Canal. But I wasn't aware that there is a significant issue facing the Panama Canal.
Okay.
And in that, in particular, that is to do with a loss of water. And I thought it was CFED. I wasn't aware that the Panama Canal...
I would have assumed it was CFED.
Yeah, exactly.
And the sea at either end, so
the water wasn't going to be an issue for it.
Yeah.
But it turns out that it's fed by a local lake. And that lake now is, even though it is the dry season, that lake is still 5 feet lower than it should be for this time of year. 5 feet doesn't sound like a lot, but on a lake that is, I think, about 80 feet deep in general,
And when you think that it takes 50 million gallons of water for every single ship that goes through the Panama Canal, that 5 feet makes a massive difference. Run that by me. And I read the article as well. So 50 million gallons of 50 million gallons of fresh water,
yeah,
for each vessel that goes through the Panama Canal.
And
there are 36 vessels per day going through the Panama Canal, and now that's down to 24. Even then, those vessels are having to be lighter, so they can't carry as much cargo, because this is all to try to save water, to try to stop this 50 million gallons per vessel going through. So even on my simple maths, that's at least a third less in vessels.
A third
of those vessels, they're each one of the two-thirds that are left,
is like
the 24 that you said, is carrying less than it was
before. And when you put that into context of 5% of global maritime trade goes through the Panama Canal, and 40% of U.S. container traffic goes through the Panama Canal.
Big numbers, aren't they?
And
I think I also read that the water from that lake is the drinking water for half of Panama's population, which is including Panama City.
So that's sort of
hierarchy of needs of, right, as a country, which is going to take higher priority, the drinking water of your population or a few ships going backwards and forwards? There will come a point where further restrictions need to be put in place.
Yeah.
Or I think I read that there's some quite grown-up planning going on for major infrastructure because it's a man-made lake. Is that right? Or
I'm not sure if it's man-made or not, but I know that they were looking to create some additional reservoirs and then potentially to dam up a local river or divert a river. And then during the rainy season, they were going to pipe water into these almost holding areas to provide the necessary water to allow them to carry on to backfeed the feeder lake, if you like.
And I'm guessing where they're going to be damming and creating more lakes is going to be taking away wildlife.
Yeah.
All the stuff that, and then we should be planting more trees, not damming it. We're damming because we don't have enough water because we damaged it.
It's a bit of a vicious circle.
Isn't there?
Second and third order effects are quite significant, but at least they are they're doing their horizon scanning, because they've based a lot of this on the fact that there are lower rainfall predictions now coming in because of global warming. They think that this situation is probably not one that's happening in isolation. It's likely to be to set the tone for where it's going.
They have actually
the chief sustainability officer in it for the first time.
And this long-term lower level means that it justifies the cost of the extra.
Yes.
So I'm assuming you can't just put it on a train and run it backwards and forwards instead of putting it on the
definite volumes we're talking about, just not. The main other option is to go round via Cape Horn. There are land routes across, but it's not as simple for this much container traffic. To land route that across is not possible. There was talk about a Nicaragua canal some years ago, but that hasn't come to anything. But just to put this into context of the supply chain, it's 5,200 miles if you want to go from New York on the East Coast, down the East Coast of America, through the Panama Canal, and round to San Francisco. It's 5,200 miles.
Okay.
The alternative is the Panama Canal. If you can't get through it, or it's not available at all, is you go down past Chile, round Cape Horn, and that's 13,000 miles.
Yeah.
So 2.5 times as far.
2 times as far.
And the additional cost, the additional carbon footprint.
Once you get into that routine, then yes, you can put in more vessels, which means that you've got more goods on the high seas so that the goods are arriving at the same throughput. But you've got a lot more cost because you've got goods sat on the high seas instead of the quick turnaround for I've made it, I've now shipped it for 3 weeks before I get my money back.
Yeah.
So it's that whole delay and the extra sort of tying up of your goods in transit rather than in the shop or the warehouse or whatever. So
And the unpredictability of if the water isn't there, and again, there are delays. We saw when Panama Canal was blocked, we saw when the Suez Canal is blocked, wasn't it?
The super tanker, yeah.
That was it, yeah. And the knock-on effect that's happened for, that was what, a week? 2 weeks?
Yeah.
That it was blocked for, and it took them a long, long time to recover. So if the Panama Canal becomes fragile, then that's going to cause significant logistic reliability issues.
I think the other bit that you mentioned, that the Suez Canal as well, so it's not happening in isolation. It would be bad if it happened just the Panama Canal, but actually the two global shortcuts are both impacted at the same time.
Yeah.
So our goods in the sea lanes of the world are now slower. They've gone back 100 years before these canals were open. Ah, right.
Yeah.
So
more confused and more expensive.
And our reliance on cheap goods from around the world is that much more than it used to be, because for a century we've gone away with being, oh, it's okay, we'll add in from Vietnam, from China, wherever. Guess what? We can still do it, but it's now coming around South Africa, it's now coming around Chile, therefore it's less predictable. And I picked up in the news the other day that the Inverness Marathon is now taking place without the ability to issue a medal or a t-shirt at the end of it, because they haven't arrived in time through the shipping channels, and therefore all this type of event are run on very limited profit margins. So the people that are talented enough to finish the marathon will have their medal and or t-shirt posted to them.
Right. Additional cost.
So that's an additional cost that means that any profit they might have made is going to be diminished, or I would guess wiped out. So any of that profit that might then have gone to good causes is now not gone to good causes, because we've got to the stage in the UK that it's cheaper to just go with, yeah, I can get 50 medals for 25 quid. We don't actually think about, but that's come from the other side of the world on a container ship, so that you can do that with all the footprint that goes with it, because we don't produce that sort of thing in the UK anymore.
But we've also come to rely on those timescales, on the short timescales that we currently have. We expect, I press my Amazon Prime and I expect next day delivery or delivery within a couple of days. And I'm sure that's what the marathon people were running on.
Yeah, that just-in-time logistics, it's speed delivery. As a child, I remember, you know, allow 28 days postage package.
Yes.
You know, for everything. You go, 28 days?
Not going to order it now.
Yeah, I want it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Don't want 28 hours, let alone 28 days.
But if you can't rely on the logistics and the supply chain to get it to you, then we might be going back to 28 days.
Yeah. And I must admit, it does hopefully bring us round from a sporting perspective of using more sustainable products for our medals. Or there's a great charity, I'll get it the wrong way around, and see the Tees for Trees or Trees for Tees, but instead of having a t-shirt, they use that money to plant a tree instead. So okay. If they have 100 people in a race, they can plant 100 trees instead of giving out 100 t-shirts. Because a lot of the people that go to these events have t-shirts already and they don't need another one, so you can elect not to. Well, how fantastic.
Very good.
Yeah. So there's quite a bit going on in the supply chain.
There is.
And from a resilience and business perspective for our listeners, I think it's just worth having a think about, where are you getting your raw materials from, or where is your supplier getting their raw materials from to build the thing that you want to buy?
Yeah.
Because although the assembly might happen in the UK, the raw materials are coming from around the world. And if one of those is delayed, for whatever reason, Panama Canal, Suez Canal, or whatever the future might be, then the product can't be built, because you can't build it without that key component.
Yeah.
And if it's not available, it's not available. So do we need to go back to the idea of larger stock in a warehouse and that ability to say, we've got that buffer zone and we've already got it available? Or do we find alternative suppliers so that we have two sources or another way of operating, but just sitting there and waiting for, oh gosh, I didn't see that coming. You really should be seeing that coming, because the supply chain of 5 years ago is not the same as the supply chain of today, and is not, today's supply chain is fragile at the moment.
I think the first thing is just definitely to identify those single points of failure, isn't it, within your supply chain.
Yeah.
And not just within your own business, but exactly as you say, where down the line, right back to the steel that makes the widget that you rely on.
Yeah.
If anyone in that chain is single point of failure.
Critical third parties, critical suppliers, critical third parties, those things that, do you know what? I'll take the time to check. It's all you're doing. You're not sticking your nose into other people's business. It's your business. that we're worried about. And if they can't do their job, then you can't do yours. So it's worth asking. Good topic. And one I think that we as a world would need to keep our eye on, these sorts of issues, because it's a small world that we now operate in. So that's Panama Canal and supply chain. The other one we were going to have a look at was some population challenges. And you picked up an interesting article in the news, I think.
I did. I picked this one up because I've got a slightly vested interest in it, and that will become apparent in a minute. But I saw that out in Benbecula, they are offering now £150,000 for a GP to go and become the GP for the six islands that make up the Outer Hebrides. And the vested interest is that my wife is a GP, and also that I love the Outer Islands. So I have tentatively mentioned it to my wife, and I got it. She laughed at me. Yes. She said, I don't want to do island medicine, but I think that it would be great. But it is indicative, I think, of a wider problem that we have this aging population, that we have got people moving out of the cities when they've made some money in the city, they move out, they bought a home, holiday home, potentially slightly earlier, or a retirement home, let's say, and all the younger people are moving into the cities. So we have this problem out in rural areas of how do we fill the jobs? And I think that's indicated further by probably teachers and education who are really struggling, as well as the medical side of things, because I know nurses are short, they're short nurses as well. But there is Rum Primary School, who are offering £68,000. Sorry, that's R-H-U-M. The Island of Rum.
Island of Rum.
Yes.
So something somewhere that...
With the gin and tonic primary school next.
Yes.
This is the...
The Island of Rum.
Island of Rum. So southeast of Benbecula, that is offering £68,000 for a teacher to go in and teach a small handful, four or five children on the island. And that is... They're not the only ones doing that. There have been a number of different isolated rural schools who are really, really struggling. And they've had to gradually inflate the wages to try to make them more attractive to bring people out. And what they really don't want are people to go out there for 6 months or 12 months. They're really looking for people to go out full time to become part of the community.
So if we just pause and do a bit of a deep dive onto some of the things that you said there. Sweeping generalization, but that bulge of the baby boomer population that are now coming up to retirement age are taking their asset as their house that they may have been able to save up for and clear their mortgage, fantastic, or they may have bought a council house from the days when the sell-off of the council houses in the 80s, I think, and the huge increase through the 80s and 90s of house prices, that if you were on the ladder, you're now sat with a huge nest egg. I remember my first house that I bought, or half bought with at the time, it went up in a year, three-bed detached house, but £40,000 to £80,000.
Nice return on your money.
That's a nice return on your money if you've got the house. If you're buying it after that period and you're now looking, I've got to pay £80,000.
Okay.
And appreciate that's in the 80s. So now that sort of house is now, stick a nought on the end of some of those prices if we're not careful. But if you're selling it, having bought it at 40,000 and you're now selling it at 400,000.
400,000 buys you a lot in a slightly more rural community.
In a rural community, and you're able to go, do you know what? I'm living the dream. I'm retiring in the countryside. It's a cliche for a reason. It's what people like to do. Okay, so we've got increase of numbers, people there, people living longer. So they're retiring in their, it's argument's sake, mid-60s, and they're living on average 15, 25 years, something like that, to 80s plus. Great. But the people who are servicing that population, who are doing the teachers, the doctors, all those things that the older generation need, are going the other way.
They are. Yeah.
And not helped by that need to have a slightly large income, the desire to be in a social setting, and therefore they're being drawn in. And I often think that, I think it was Tony Blair's quote of education, education, education in the late 90s, and that's what we want, social mobility. Well, if you move from the countryside as an 18-year-old, suddenly exposed to a university town, the draw to go back to the countryside is, yes, family is very important and all the rest of it, but I can get a good job here and variety and flexibility and social life and sports clubs and that. it's a hard ask to get you back to the countryside and bring up a young family where you know that it's going to be tough.
Yeah. So the young people are all moving into the cities, and the older people, either with their nest egg, are moving out, or who've got a skill and can do it, can work remotely.
Yep.
So the prevalence of remote working as well, and the fact that we can now either get satellite broadband or we've got super fast broadband, just a lot of homes, or majority of homes now, even those in rural locations, people can work.
Yeah.
But that job that would ordinarily be in a city is not necessarily the skills that are needed in the rural areas. So the tradespeople and things in the rural areas, the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, that's where the real shortage is.
In Scotland, there's a newspaper called The Herald, and the front page of The Herald talked about the second Highland clearances, that idea that it's a big deal in Scotland, and I appreciate we're being parochial, being a Scottish company. Is it a big deal around the world? Is Scotland unique? Or
I don't think it's limited to Scotland at all. I think it's almost a global phenomenon. A global, certainly UK-wide, but we certainly have a shrinking population in general.
Yeah, because I'm sure I read something about Japan is suffering hugely. Spain and Italy, and if you do a sort of Google search, you'll get the stats. But
China has gone down years to come by. China population was in a boom, massive boom. Now it's declining.
So given that today in the UK is the spring budget has been announced, so people thinking about money, and the triple lock pension is going to stay in place, which means I think for the pension increase in the UK is, it depends on which measure they use, but it's either going to be 8.5% or 6.5% increase. So there are fewer people earning money now, because the birth rate has also gone down, certainly compared to the clues in the title, baby boom. I think it's gone down since then. Fewer people earning money to pay the pension, and there are more people drawing the pension because all the baby boomers are now pensioners.
Hence the big holes in the pension pots.
Hence the huge holes in the pension pots. But if you are trying to service that as a government, or as a company, the money isn't there, because you don't save money into your pension. People paying their money today are paying for the pensioners of today. So all the pensioners of today, their pension contributions paid for their parents' pension. So our contributions into the pension pot are paying for people who are already retired. So when we get to retire, it's our children that will be paying our pension. It's not got into a savings fund. So it's this idea that the fewer people that are contributing the pension, the less money there is, but more people that are expecting it. And we keep ramping it up, and we keep ramping it up. So at some point, that bubble is going to burst. People crying into their hankies over that, I think.
I'm sure. Hopefully it's something that will work its way through the system. If we do go into population decline, that is something that in the long term, I think, will be beneficial. But I think we've probably got 30 or 40 years of potentially pain while this shrinking population actually works its way through.
I don't think I want to finish on a doom and gloom message, so we won't finish just now.
No.
But that observation that the generation coming through the system now, the recent graduates, the late 20s, 30-year-olds, I think we're right in saying that for the first time, the predictions are that that generation is going to die younger than their parents. It's going to take them longer to afford a house than their parents. And we've now said that the pension bubble for 30 years they're going to be living with is poorer, because they're paying someone to have a nice pension uplift when they can't even afford a house. And we've saddled them with graduate debt that their parents didn't have, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not really that promising a forecast for the youngster.
I'm going to finish on a better note. I'm going to finish on a better note and say that once we work that one way through, I think, and this is an opinion, but it's based on some reading, that if that population does go down, I think we are going to be setting ourselves up for the better in the long term.
Oh, I agree.
We'll be in a much better place. Some studies have shown that they think that the world has reached its maximum capacity of sort of 8 billion or so. And that actually by going down now, we will have less of an environmental impact. So we will actually be, hopefully, not repairing the damage, but we will be doing less damage. So we might be in a slightly better position, in the future for our children and then our children's children. So the longer term view, slightly more rosy potentially than the short term view.
Let's leave it there.
Let's leave it there.
That's a good place to finish. The longer term view is rosier than the short and medium term view. David, thank you very much for joining me today. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please tell your friends. If you haven't enjoyed it, please tell us. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for listening.
Thank you very much.